Hi, I'm Sima Shapiro, the host of the new Contemporary Lifestyle Radio Show for Women Over 40, featuring everything about your health, wealth, children, happiness, and anything else of interest to you, the listener. Please stay tuned. Hi and welcome. I'm Sima Shapiro, your host of For Women Over 40. Today we'll be talking about the state of adoption in the U.S. with one of the most distinguished voices in the field, a man whose work has surrounded the vast topic of adoption. Adam Pertman is president and founder of the National Center on Adoption and Permanency, a unique one-stop organization that provides information, resources, education, training, consulting, and advocacy to improve the lives of children, families, and the professionals who serve them. Adam is one of the most highly regarded experts, authors, and keynote speakers in the field of adoption and foster care. He speaks, writes, and presents internationally, appears regularly in the media, and has received numerous honors for his work. His book, Adoption Nation, is considered one of the most preeminent books on adoption in this country. Previously, he served as chief executive of the Donaldson Adoption Institute for over a decade and was a longtime senior journalist at the Boston Globe. So welcome, Adam.
Thank you for having me. I hope the show is long enough to accommodate the introduction.
I know. You're right. You're absolutely right. Well, you know what? You deserve it. So before we get into the nitty-gritty on the topic, I'd like you to tell me a little bit about your own personal journey and your interest in the world of adoption.
Sure. I'll try to make it short. It was really a confluence of journeys. One was professional. I was a reporter and editor at the Boston Globe. And the other was personal. And my wife and I discovered 20-something years ago that we were infertile and couldn't make babies, and we wanted a family. So the two really came together because as my wife and I, Judy and I, we were certainly middle-aged parents, began to look at how we do that, looked at adoption. I saw a world that I didn't understand very well and that I thought many people did not understand very well, and that put up my journalistic antennae, right? I wanted to write about that world. And so I did, and it led to a Pulitzer-nominated series in the Boston Globe. And that led to my first book, Adoption Nation, the new edition of which is out now. And it changed my career. You know, I jumped ship. I left the Globe and decided I needed to do something for my kids, for my family, in the next chapter of my life. And that's what I've been doing ever since.
So what is the passion? What is the impetus behind all of this? I mean, I understand the story and the journey.
Yeah.
But what touches your soul and your heart with regard to adoption?
It's a good question. I don't get asked that. Thank you. It's a social justice issue for me. What I discovered in reporting both the series that I did and then subsequently the book was that this was an unfair world that my kids were going to grow up in, and they didn't do anything wrong. And it was not only unfair to them, you know, in which they were stigmatized. The words, you're adopted, are to this day still used as an insult. Well, my kids aren't an insult, and neither are anybody else's, and neither is the institution that put them into a family. And it didn't just go for them. Birth parents are still shamed. Adoptive parents are lauded, and then people say, but I am sorry you couldn't have any real children. Well, my kids look real, and if I'm so everything's so wonderful, why do you feel sorry for me? So everybody sort of wears some stigma, some shame, and the laws and policies, I won't go too deep into that, I discovered are not fair to our families or to the families of origin either. And so it was really a social justice issue for me that captured that passion. I had a board chair who told me, stop saying this, but I'll say it anyway. I wanted to change the world for my kids, and that hasn't changed. You know, my kids are grown up, but there are so many like them, and so many for whom the world is not a fair place, and somebody's got to be working to not just help them, you know, on the ground as a social worker, but somebody's got to be changing it at a systems level, and that's what I've dedicated myself to.
Sure. So to give the listener some context, let's get to some stats. If we were to look at the last 50 years of adoption, what would we see, and what would we see in our most recent decade?
What we would see is a roughly level number of adoptions total, but the nature of those adoptions have changed radically. I mean, the subtitle of Adoption Nation, the new edition, is how the adoption revolution is transforming our families and America. Well, there are a lot of components of that, and I'm going to answer your question using them. The changes are really revolutionary. I mean, adoption has been turned inside out as a process. Formal adoption in America was about white babies born to white unwed mothers who were then parented by white married people. That was adoption in America, and policy and practice and our understandings and all that were built on that foundation. For the most part, that foundation is still standing, but the realities have radically changed, and I'll enumerate them real quick. And these have huge impact on our families, I think, across the board, across America, and on the country itself. We can talk about that if you want. But the changes, and in no particular order, are, A, we've gone from almost entirely closed system in which everyone was shamed and everyone was in a closet. People wouldn't talk about it. And virtually every adoption was a closed adoption, to a time when 90% plus of infant adoptions are open adoptions today. And openness and honesty relating to adoption is not just the best practice, but the reality for the most part. I mean, we still have a ways to go, but the process has changed radically. And for everyone concerned, it has changed, right? I mean, we do not denigrate adopted people, call them bastards and illegitimate, which we did. We try not to shame all parties involved, though we sometimes still do. And so we still have work to do. And then the participants have changed. So I talked about the foundation of, and I'll try to make this in a capsule and move on, but the white babies born to white unwed mothers, that base is really important to remember, because jumping ahead that 50 years, what we have today is overwhelmingly the majority of children who are adopted are not infants, are not white, are in sibling groups, are children of color, etc., and they're mostly from foster care or from institutions abroad, which means they've suffered some trauma or maltreatment early in their lives, not those little infants of yesteryear. And the parents are no longer the ones that we still think of. They are gay and straight, married and single, of every age, a lot of them older, you know, your audience. And so virtually everything about the institution has changed and about its participants has changed, but the laws, policies, practices, and understanding have not changed so much, and that's why I have a job.
And so the first statement that you said, do you mean that the total number of adoptions has remained as a flat line? Is that how you...
More or less, we think. There's no sort of central registry, but it's in the ballpark, give or take 10,000, of about 120,000 a year, including step-parent adoptions. But most of those, most of the non-step-parent adoptions used to be, overwhelmingly, were white babies born to white unwed mothers, formal adoptions, then parented by white married people, adoptive
sure.
parents. And today, that segment is tiny. Maybe it may be 10%. It's probably more like 6 or 7.
I find this hard to wrap my head around, because I was so sure you were going to tell me that over the last 50 years, it's grown and it's burgeoned. I mean, it's on the forefront of societal discussions, ills. You know what I mean?
I do indeed. So I'll give you a rough analogy. 50 years ago, there were no gay people in America.
Right.
But of course there were. They were in the closet, and so is adoption.
Sure.
What we've seen, and the reason we think adoption is so much more prevalent today, is because, A, we're not hiding. We're talking about it. We're on the radio, right?
Yes.
And in the news, and to our friends, et cetera, et cetera. But also because it's so much more visible. That adoption that was 50 years ago, you know, the white babies born white unwed mothers, literally social workers, quote, matched babies to the parents, so that it would be invisible. People didn't tell their own kids they were adopted.
Sure.
And today, you know, it's hard to say, yes, I gave birth to my Chinese daughter, but I happen to be white.
Yes.
I mean, that's a rough sell. So institutionally, it's much more visible. And thank God, as a matter of social justice, as a matter of pride in our families and shedding the shame, we talk about it. We have made it visible.
So what has changed in the world of domestic versus international adoptions? And again, if we could use that sort of 50-year framework.
Well, the domestic adoption changes more or less what I described to you, you know, from closed adoptions to open adoption, from stigma to less stigma, from not talking about it at all to it being a part of the national conversation, which is a very good thing. You can't make progress from inside the closet. Another good LGBT analogy. Whatever people think of the changes that have occurred, you can certainly agree that no progress was made when nobody would talk about it, when nobody would advocate, nobody tried to change anything. And the same was true for us. So on a domestic level, more or less what I just described is the scenario. And international adoption fueled it enormously, because, again, the families formed with children from Korea, from Latin America, from Africa, from Asia, they're very visible, and so they fuel this phenomenon of this revolution that I described. Wait, one more thing on domestic. 50 years ago, the permanency plan for children from foster care was foster care. And so as the number of babies, those white babies I was describing, as that number fell because women started parenting their own children as the stigma evaporated, the number of children from adopted from abroad rose. And because of policy changes, mainly under the Clinton administration, the incentives to adopt from foster cares increased. And people, turned out, were more than willing to adopt children who needed some help, but they need the resources to raise those children. And so one big change domestically is that the majority of domestic adoptions, non-step parents, are of children from foster care. That's a huge change. Internationally, we seen an increase and then a decline during that 50 years. The increase to about the peak of international adoptions was about 22,000 about 10 years ago, and it's been declining ever since, and we can discuss why. But this past year, the number was total number of adoptions from other countries into this one was under 7,000.
So I would like to discuss the why, but before I do, I just wondered, in terms of the demographics of people who are adopting domestically versus internationally, are they basically the same?
Very different. The demographics of the people adopting internationally, this is really with a broad brush, are roughly the same group that adopt infants domestically still today.
Okay.
And there are about 14,000 of those each year. But again, not all white babies, not all white married parents, but
sure,
babies nevertheless. And the reasons for that is socioeconomic. I mean, to adopt a baby domestically or a child from abroad generally costs anywhere from $20,000 to $40,000, sometimes more. So you got to have that money. And the people who adopt from foster care overwhelmingly are more middle to lower middle class and economically even down from there. So it's different population groups.
Referencing your previous comment about the decline in international adoptions, what do you attribute that to?
Well, a lot of people have looked at this and come up with different answers. Mine sort of takes all of their answers under one umbrella, and the umbrella is the world started watching. When the boom in international adoption started was coincided with two international events. One was China's imposition of a one-child policy, which led to abandonment of a lot of little girls, then were adopted, and the breakup of the Soviet Union, which led us to see that there were orphanages teeming with children, first with Romania, where people were literally going, Americans and others were going over and literally just getting kids off the streets. Well, it was a time when there wasn't a lot of monitoring, regulation, oversight of the process. People were literally getting kids off the street. We regulate snow tires more than that.
Sure.
So part of the answer, part, are new international rules and regulations, but I don't think they so much led to the decline as they were part of an overall scene in which the media was paying attention, parent groups were paying attention. Very importantly, other countries started paying attention. And as they did, they discovered, and meanwhile, the numbers were going up and up because it was fairly easy to do, and there were a lot of kids. But over time, we discovered, hey, suddenly Guatemala is the biggest country from which Americans are adopting. Well, Guatemala is a dot on the map, and more kids are being adopted from there than from China
mm-hmm.
or from Russia.
Yep.
And so people started paying attention and realizing there's some not-so-good stuff going on there. Now, I don't like all the answers that people use to address that problem. They shut down the whole country. Well, I'm not sure keeping kids in orphanages for longer is the answer, but you do have to pay attention. You do have to try to do the right thing. Now, directly answer to your question, it is a confluence of individual circumstances. So, in other words, China did not close down its one-child policy because of the Hague Convention on Inter-Country Adoption or because of anything other than their own domestic needs. But that change has led to adopting from China can take 5 years, and the only children available are older, have special needs, etc. I mean, it's a good thing. They need homes, but it has changed dramatically. Russia did not close down adoptions because of anything to do with adoptions. It had to do with domestic politics and international politics. So the reasons are different in each country,
mm-hmm.
but just to use Russia as an example, the world was watching and Russia knew that that's where it could put a stick in the eye of the U.S., that it would really hurt. So it's the paying attention, I think, that has led to the decline for the most part. And nationalism, countries don't want the world to think they can't care for their own children.
I think my question was, do you think that the media attention on these other countries forced them to have some sort of circumspection themselves about their own practices and what they were doing with their children?
Some circumspection, some nationalism, and some embarrassment.
Sure.
Some combination. And by the way, it's true for our country as well. One thing we've learned as we started paying attention is that there are children being adopted from the U.S. into other countries. So, you know, these are issues that all countries face. I am all for children staying in their own countries and their families of origin whenever you can, but I think we haven't thought this through very well, and we know from research that one consequence of all these changes is that children are now living in orphanages longer, and that is not good for any kid. We know that.
Sure. So, referencing back about this being a taboo subject, what are some of the other factors in the United States for pushing this into the forefront? I understand the media, but there's much more of a dialogue now, and it just seems as if so many of the other sociological entities have sort of come together to make this possible. Would you agree?
Oh, I certainly agree. It's never any one factor. I think as an institution sort of comes out of the closet, so does everyone within it, right?
Yes.
And so do the people who study institutions. So, for example, I've been doing research in adoption for about 15 years. If you go back much further, there isn't a whole lot there because you don't do research on secret. And so part of it is media, but media is reactive. I was part of the media for a long time. I know that. Media drives the debate, but it also responds to it. So I'll use this as an example. So why did adoptions become open? People make lots of assumptions of why that happened. But historically, the reason it happened is because women birth mothers, the colloquial term for women who place their kids for adoption, birth mothers were starting to come back to their agencies in big numbers saying, I want to know what happened to my kid. And pregnant women who were thinking of placing for adoption started telling their agencies, I'm not giving up my kid if I can never see him again. And so we turned women into baby-making machines in the era of secrecy. We gave them very few rights and very little respect. And it turns out they didn't like that so much.
Sure, sure, sure.
And so, again, when coming out of the closet, people start speaking for themselves. The same is true for adoptive parent groups. The same is absolutely true for adult adoptees now growing up in a generation where they can talk about it. They are out there at the front lines looking to equalize those rights I talked about earlier and saying, why do I get less than, you know, my brother who was born into the family?
Sure. With this population of new midlife parenting, non-traditional families, push for international and national adoption, the trend of adoption has now led to a host of other businesses. There's the business of adoption, all
Absolutely.
Of the ancillary spokes of the wheel. But the truth of the matter is that some of the spokes have been created as a result of the trauma, the dysregulation that so many of these kids go through. Can you address these kinds of differing spokes and how it's created new industries?
Wow, that's a lot of question because I think it's a good one, but there are so many spokes of this wheel that I'll just pick a few. So there's always been some industry aspect to it, right? I mean, you have agencies and attorneys and then facilitators and others who in one way or another made their living off adoption. I'm not denigrating them, criticizing them. Some did a great job, some were in it for the money, but that has always existed. The growth today, and I'm going to just pick two examples to support your point, the growth today, unfortunately, is of internet providers. That's where the industry is really heading, and it's not mainly a good thing because we don't even know what some of those providers are. I mean, are they attorneys? Are they social workers? They are people who say, we will get you a baby in 6 to 9 months. Well, how do you do that?
Sure.
How do you guarantee that online to every single person who goes online? So that is a very troublesome part of the industry. On the other hand, just to be fair, the internet is also a place of enormous support, resources, education in every realm, including in adoption. So it's not a one-sided deal. But in those sort of problematic industry terms, the internet is the place that it's happening. And we're back to that world where no one is monitoring, no one is regulating. And that's a little bit scary.
Adam, are there no regulations for those types of industries online?
That's right.
Okay.
Simple, straightforward answer. That is correct. And it is a bit unnerving. You should see the stuff that is out there. It is not healthy, but it is tempting, right? It's tempting for a midlife parent to look online or anyone, a would-be parent, and say, hey, a baby in 6 to 9 months, cool, let's do it. Well, you may be fueling something you don't mean to be.
Sure.
And I strongly suggest you do a lot of homework. If something sounds like it may be too good to be true, be careful. But the point is that there is no industry umbrella group that vets these places, that tells you what's good and what's bad practice, what is somebody doing that's ethical or unethical. That's not out there, and it's unfortunate. The other thing I wanted to say in terms of, quote, industry, because it's a troublesome word, not because it's not accurate, but because sometimes the connotation is negative, and some elements of it are very positive. So I gave you a negative one. A very positive one is that people are finally, the industry, quote, is finally realizing that as a result of this changed demographic that I described to you, there are a whole lot more children today who were abused, neglected, institutionalized, who are being adopted. And so we can't use the same paradigm. We can't say, okay, we formed the family and we're done. Good luck to you. So part of the industry is to train more mental health professionals in adoption-related issues so they can help these children and families. And by the way, that's what my new organization, National Center on Adoption and Permanency, NCAP, for your listeners, NCAP, NCAP, is all about.
We're talking today with Adam Pertman, president and founder of the National Center on Adoption and Permanency, and we're talking about every aspect we can possibly pack into this half hour about adoption. So, Adam, keep going about the discussion about dysregulation and trauma and the spokes of the wheel that are addressing this. Is there any regulation to those types of...
No. What there is a growing realization among professionals, and this is tying a couple pieces together. This is why it's so tricky to just pick a provider on the internet who just says, I'll get you a kid. Well, where's the kid from? Might there be some issues in life? Might you need some education and guidance? Might you need some services later? None of that is a bad thing, though some people say, oh my God, I wanted a perfectly healthy baby. Well, good luck, whether you're making one or adopting one. I hope it works for you, because there are no guarantees. And so the question is, if we're going to address the people who really are with us, i.e. the children and the parents, this changed demographic, we need to change how we do things. Sure. And so one of those changes is understanding that children who have suffered from trauma, maltreatment early in life, before the adoption, might need some help later, and your family might need some help later. And so I'm going to bring this to NCAP, my organization. So my organization's mission is very ambitious and I think very necessary. It is to move the model on which we have always worked in adoption, foster care, child welfare, which is a child placement model. Every child deserves a loving, safe, and permanent family. So when we have structured everything around achieving that, well, that might or might not have been sufficient in the past, but with a population of children who have issues in their lives and parents who have to deal with those issues, we better change what we're doing and move the goalposts so that we're helping families succeed and not just placing children. Sure. And that is the model that we are working toward.
What federal, state, local laws, the policies, and practices have come into play positively in reaction to this new burgeoning field of adoption?
Well, the answer is very few. I mean, law and policy are not there yet. Practice is getting there. As I said, you know, we have more professionals more aware of what the real needs of today are.
What policies and laws are still needed, and how do you envision that this brave new world will be navigated in the next 10 or 20 years?
Well, I'm not sure how it will be navigated. I know it won't happen by itself. Again, that's why NCAP, I think, is so important. I think it's probably now the only nonprofit dedicated. Lots of people are doing the work or trying to do bits and pieces of the work. NCAP is the only organization that says we can't do it in bits and pieces. This has to be about changed policy. This has to be about changed law and practice. And that's what we're going to work very hard to achieve. And I urge people to look at our website, which is, forgive me, ncap-us.org, and take a look, because we also provide services and consultation and training and all that kind of stuff, but all with the intent of changing the paradigm. So what does it look like in 20 years? I hope if we do our work, not just NCAP, but others, if we do our work, what it needs to look like is that we have a fundamental shift in law, policy, and practice so that the end game, the goal, becomes one of enabling families to succeed. What education, resources, services, supports do they need in order to succeed, in order to let the children grow up whole and for the families to continue whole? Because right now what we're doing, because of this changed demographic, is forming tens of thousands of families every year. Because remember where the kids are coming from now. Tens of families every year where life is a struggle every day. So we haven't done our jobs just by putting kids in safe, permanent, loving families. Those families are safe, permanent, loving. but they need something else to be successful, and that's what we aren't giving them.
Do you envision that at some point you will have solid lobbyists working nonstop, or do you envision that this type of life will need to infiltrate on the legislative level so that it becomes a more personal situation for the people who can be making some changes for you?
Well, my honest answer is we will go off in all directions at once. I think practice on the internet will probably continue to stink, even if there are some regulations imposed, because it's very, very hard to regulate that new technology. We've seen it in so many other areas. But we need to try. We need to address it. I think children's lives are almost as important as gambling on the internet. So I think and hope we will finally address that part of it. And it'll be uneven because there will be agencies that do it and states that do it, because adoption, is, for everyone's edification, is an absolutely state-by-state issue in law. And so some states will do a better job. Some states are, in fact, trying to do a better job of using sort of a success model instead of just a placement model, and others are doing nothing. And so it will be very uneven, and we will need allies, you know, at every level.
Do you envision that the topic of adoption is one of the impetuses behind the increase in FMLA usage, interest, or maternal leave acts?
I don't know it for a fact, but I would be surprised if it weren't true. It stands to reason. As people age, people form their families differently, people are more educated, people, and I think there's some change in how people are thinking about their families in America, too, and deciding that, hey, it's important if I spend some time with mine. And so I think all of those social changes combine to answer your question at a bottom line, yes.
So we're almost,
I think.
Sure, I think so, too. We're almost out of time, and I'm wondering what words you'd like to leave the listener with today, what tips or thoughts?
I think we've really covered the
territory. Oh, yeah, we did a good job.
I think if I want to leave people with anything, it's with a new understanding of this adoption world, this child welfare world, because it's not just adoption, this child welfare world that we have now. It's not sufficiently well understood, and if you don't understand something well, it's really hard to make it work well.
Sure.
And so I urge people, whether they're just curious or they're really interested for personal reasons or professional reasons, I urge them to take a look at the NCAP website, look at others as well, and educate yourself about the world in which we live, and we will all make better decisions as a result.
Sure. We've been talking with the president and founder of the National Center on Adoption and Permanency. Again, Adam Pertman can be found at www.ncap-us.org. This has been a great half hour, Adam. Thank you so much for your time.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you to the listener for joining us on For Women Over 40. I'm your host, Sima Shapiro, and until next time, I hope you take care.